actually. Please come with me to the New Testament and look at some of the places where she's mentioned in the New Testament. Of course, the first of them in Matthew chapter 1, and to try and get a sense of why the New Testament writers thought that Rahab was remarkable. So Matthew chapter 1, very first few verses of the explanation of who Jesus Christ was. And it starts, "The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Amminadab, and Amminadab the father of Nashon, and Nashon the father of Salmon, and Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz the father of Obed by Ruth. Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David the king. And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah." So often when I've done first principles talks on the promises to the fathers, I would actually start in the New Testament because it's not always obvious to people who don't have, I guess, a Christadelphian history that the Old Testament is still relevant. So I would come to passages like this and others that we'll read to explain to people why we should care who Abraham was and who the patriarchs were. So it's interesting in that context that in this section here where Matthew is starting to tell us who the Son of God was, he does start with the people that we would expect. He starts with Abraham and David and people like that. But Matthew also makes a point of mentioning Tamar and Rahab and Ruth and, of course, Bathsheba. And, you know, without getting into an explanation of why each of those would have been picked, I think we're being told something about who the Son of God was just by the fact that they choose to mention these particular women in his lineage. As a bit of a side note here, I think there's a case here for the inspiration of the scriptures, in that I don't think anyone would argue that the New Testament was written much after the Old Testament, and unless from the very beginning the Old Testament had been oriented to tell us who Christ was, why would you particularly have spent time on the stories of Tamar and Rahab and Ruth, of all the other people who lived in those times, unless this book actually does have one author who has been crafting the story of Jesus from the very beginning? And so I think the fact that we have in the Old Testament the stories of these women tells us something about the inspiration of the Bible. So this is the first place in the New Testament where Rahab is mentioned. And come with me to Hebrews. In Hebrews chapter 11, which, again, these are all passages we know very well. In Hebrews chapter 11, in the first 30 verses of the chapter, talking about the faith of different people of the Old Testament, we have a lot of people that, again, we would very much expect to be in there. People like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Sarah and Moses. And the writer, when transitioning from the people he specifically wants to mention into saying, you know, I don't have time to talk about everyone else, he does stop himself in verse 31 to say, "By faith, Rahab the prostitute did not perish with those who were disobedient, because she had given a friendly welcome to the spies." And then he'll go on to say, I don't really have time to talk about everyone else. He does want us to notice Rahab in the faith that she had. And if you just turn over a couple pages to James chapter 2, is the third reference in the New Testament. And again, James chapter 2 is a discussion of faith, and when we're talking about faith, we would very much expect to hear about Abraham and the sacrifice of Isaac and how Abraham trusted God enough to offer his only son, the son of the promise. But having the entire Old Testament to draw upon, we might not have so much expected James to pick up on Rahab. And I'm not sure exactly what the reason for that is. You know, maybe he's contrasting a Gentile, Rahab the Gentile versus Abraham the Hebrew, or maybe a woman, Rahab the woman versus Abraham the man. Or perhaps he's contrasting an act of instinctive, spontaneous faith with Abraham's faith, which was more developed over time. I'm not too sure, but the fact remains that when James wants to talk to us about what faith is and what faith turns into, he picks two people. He picks Abraham and he picks Rahab. And in a more abstract way, another way in which Rahab has impressed me is that I compare her to Lot, that when the chips were down and when the city was about to be destroyed and Lot calls out to his family, his relatives think he's joking and no one takes him seriously. When Rahab calls out to her family, she does fill a house with people who want to be saved. So I think there's something, obviously the circumstances were different. Lot only had a couple angels in his house. Rahab had an entire army surrounding the city. But there's something about the quality of this woman that doesn't just, it isn't just coming out in abstract acts of faith, that she was recognized by her family. Her family trusted and believed in her, and they go to her house to save themselves. So from the New Testament, I believe that we can say that time with Rahab is time well spent. And so I'd like us to just spend a few minutes with her this morning. So come back with me to Joshua now. And let's try and learn a little bit more about her and about her character and about the choices that she makes. So Joshua chapter 2, and starting just in verse 1, it says, "And Joshua the son of Nun sent two men secretly from Shittim as spies, saying, 'Go, view the land, especially Jericho.' And they went, and they came into the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab, and they lodged there." So you don't have to look this one up, but if you look back, you don't have to look this one up, but back in the beginning of Deuteronomy, when they first sent the spies out, there's definitely an element of fear and uncertainty in their reasoning. So in Deuteronomy chapter 1, it says, Moses is talking to the people, and he says, "See, the Lord your God has set the land before you. Go take possession of it. Do not be dismayed. And then all of you came to me and said, 'Let's send men before us that we may explore the land and they may bring us word again.'" And so the context of sending the first spies out is a context of a certain uncertainty and fearfulness in the people. And of course, we know how that turned out. The spies, 10 of the spies, brought a poor report back, and it turned the hearts of the people away from them, and they had to head back into the desert. So it's not surprising that Joshua should choose to do it secretly, because the first time it hadn't turned out so well. But if you look at Joshua chapter 1, which would have been our readings for today, there's a consistent theme of God trying to encourage him, of God saying to Joshua, take heart, don't fear, be courageous. So when Joshua sends the spies, there's probably some uncertainty in his mind about the road that lies ahead. So the spies go out, and I'm sure they thought they had planned it well. Like the purpose of being a spy would be to be unnoticed, you would think. Looking at the timing here, it almost seems like they're getting to the city in the late afternoon, which might also be the time when everyone's starting to come into the city from the fields. And so perhaps they thought they had the right clothes on, and they thought they'd trimmed their beards right, and they had the right haircuts, and their fake accents and all that. But for some reason, I expect that as they're walking into town, they can already tell that people notice that they're different, and that people are probably whispering behind them, and no one really wants to do anything. But I fully expect that when these spies entered the city, they were already afraid. They were afraid that they had been recognized, and they're looking for a place to go to ground, as it were, and wait till nightfall when people might not see them. So the question is, what kind of operation exactly is Rahab running there? And one of the possibilities is that she had, and this is somewhat anachronistic, but maybe sort of the old Western style bar where there's smoky room with some tables in the corners where people can kind of sneak off to the edge and no one would notice them till nightfall. So maybe that's the situation, that it's really kind of an inn or a lodging place that they find as they edge into the city. Or maybe they're walking down a road trying to find a place to hide, and Rahab is standing with an inviting look in the doorway, looking for customers, as it were. We don't really know exactly how it is that they align. The interesting thing to me is how quickly Rahab seems to understand what is going on and how quickly she takes action. Let's keep reading here in verses 2 to 6. It says, "It was told to the king of Jericho, 'Behold, the men of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land.' Then the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, 'Bring out the men who have come to you, who entered your house, for they have come to search out the land.' But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them." And she said, so at this point, by the time the king sends the man there, the other people who had been looking at them had not taken action. They're still afraid or uncertain, but they send word to the king. Rahab has very quickly assessed what the situation is here, because you don't end up lying on a roof under stalks of flax without a prior conversation about, without some common understanding about what's going on. And so Rahab has understood who they are, has understood what they're there for, and has hidden them, and they have had trust in her to go along with the plan. So the king sends the men to her at the end of verse 4, and she says, "True, the men came to me, but I didn't know where they were from. And when the gate was about to be closed at dark, the men went out. I don't know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you'll overtake them." But she'd brought them up to the roof and hid them under with the stalks of flax that she'd laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued after them on the way to the Jordan as far as the fords, and the gate was shut as soon as the pursuers had gone out. So she's hidden them, and she has a story for the men of the king when they arrive, and she sends them off. It's about a 10-kilometer distance, so I guess the men thought that if they ran, they might catch them before they crossed the river. And they seem to be safe. It's interesting. This is almost identical to the situation you might remember where Jonathan and Ahimaaz had stayed behind to give a report to David about what Absalom was doing. And a woman saves their lives in much the same way when they get caught while they're spying. So this is where we again rejoin Rahab, where she's talking to the men just before they settle down for a few hours before making a run in the middle of the night. And let's read in verses 8 and forward the statement of her faith. So in verse 8 it says, "Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to them, 'I know the Lord has given you the land.'" And from the very beginning here, there's an echo of the promises to Abraham. It's somehow, with very little knowledge of what has been going on, she has already aligned herself with God's purpose, that God's people will inherit the land. I also hear in her words more of an echo of the words of Jonathan to David, when Jonathan is saying to him, "I know that God has given you this kingdom." Sort of, there's a faith, but there's a wistfulness maybe in there about what might have been, about a past that is going to end in a completely different future that will lie ahead. And so Rahab isn't just talking about any land. She's talking about this land where she now lives with her family and everyone she's ever known. And it's almost the same kind of faith, like I say, that Jonathan would have had to have, that when he decides that he is going to align himself with David, that is closing a door on everything that he had had in the past up till that point. And so she tells them that she knows that the land will be theirs. She tells them of the fear at the end of verse 9, that "the fear of you has fallen us on us, and all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we've heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, who you devoted to destruction." So she talks about everything, like the crossing of the Red Sea goes back some 40 years, or close to it. And so she talks about believing that God had done that. And you think about the people who lived in this area for those 38 years when Israelites disappeared into the desert, and they would have heard rumors of what was going on, and some people might have run across them, and stories would have filtered out. And you would think of the apprehension as they came out, and then as they went by Edom and they went by Moab and they didn't do anything, and people's mixed feelings and terrors, and then eventually they completely destroy the first two Canaanite kings of Og and of Sihon. And so these are the things that she believes come from God. And then In the next verse, it's almost as she reiterates their fear. As soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. And the next thing she says is almost a direct quote from Moses' speech in Deuteronomy. It says, "For the Lord your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath." And this is back in Deuteronomy 4:39. Where Moses says almost the exact same thing. "Know therefore today and lay it in your heart that the Lord is God in heaven above and on the earth beneath. There is no other." So you can see the spies having this conversation with her and trying to decide, do we trust this woman? Do we trust what she's telling us to do? Is she just trying to get us out of the way while she calls the soldiers? And then these words, which would have echoed what they heard themselves not that long ago from Moses himself. And to me, this echoes of a couple different instances. It echoes of the men on the road to Emmaus, that they would have said, "Our hearts burned within us." And the way that she talked was like, this sounds like the way someone else is talking. It also makes me think of Peter, where Peter says to the men who are with him in the presence of Cornelius and the outpouring of the Spirit upon Cornelius and his family, "Can anyone prevent these people from being baptized, for they've received the Holy Spirit even as we have?" So you could see the spies listening to this woman, and she's saying, "We're fearful and we believe this thing is happening." And then they say almost the exact same words that Moses had said maybe a month before to them. And I would think that that would have been a tipping point for them, that they would have seen this as God at work. And so they agree to how they're going to carry out the plan, and she recommends they stay there for a bit, that they head off into the forest, not directly back to the river, and they agree how she will leave them a sign for her to be saved. So when we talk about lessons from this, one of the things that comes to me is the topic I did a lecture on a few weeks ago about predestination versus free will. And my conclusion in the lecture was that, yes, both things are absolutely true. Because it stretches the limits of credibility to think that it would be completely accidental that these men would have walked into this city and tripped upon this one woman who is willing to believe that the God of Israel is God in heaven and earth and wants to risk her life to save them. So there seems to be no possibility that this was purely accidental. So you see the hand of God acting in her life, in their lives, and as we'll see later in the life of Joshua. And yet when she made that choice, I don't think that we can take that choice away from her and say that she was just an instrument of God who made her act in a certain way. I believe that she put her life on the line for these men and to align herself with God's people. And in that moment when she opened the door, or when she was standing in the street and she saw these two stressed out strangers with, you know, their funny clothes or whatever it was that made it known that they were from Israel, she made a choice right then of what people she was going to align herself with. She did what Abraham did. She turned her back on her people before. She did what Ruth did without the advantage of having known someone like Naomi for months and years. She made a choice. She left her people and she aligned herself with God's. And so I think there's the hand of God there in her life without doubt. And there's also her choice to pick a path. And so, of course, the question then for us is, when we have these moments, when we have these choices where we decide which people are we going to align ourselves with, what will be our choice? Which people will we decide to go with? If you come with me to Matthew, Matthew 21, I'll ask you to read this one with me. Matthew chapter 21, 28 to 32. Matthew 21, 28, and says, "What do you think? A man had two sons, and he went to the first and said, 'Son, go and work in the vineyard today.' And he answered, 'I will not.' But afterwards he changed his mind and went. And he went to the other son and said the same. And he answered, I go, sir, but did not go. Which of the two did the will of the Father? And they said, the first. And Jesus said to them, truly I say to you, the tax collectors and the prostitutes go into the kingdom of God before you. For John came to you in the way of righteousness, and you didn't believe in him. But the tax collectors and the prostitutes believed him. And even when you saw it, you did not afterwards change your mind and believe in him. So one of the biggest lessons from Rahab is that no matter what we had behind, no matter what choices we have made or what life we have led, there will come a moment when we can make a decision about what people we want to be part of. And at that point, whatever was behind will not matter. And we can just join a new people and walk forward with them. The second lesson, the second main lesson that I took from this chapter is a theme of finding encouragement in unexpected places. So if you come back with me to Joshua, and often when we hear talks or do classes on Joshua chapter 1, we key in on this phrase that's repeated throughout this chapter, be strong and courageous, be strong and courageous. So let's read in Joshua chapter 1, verses 5 to 7, or 5 to 9, I guess. So God is speaking to Joshua, and he's saying, beginning in verse 5, no man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to do all the law that Moses, my servant, commanded you. If you jump forward to verse 9 here, he says, Have not I commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Don't be frightened. Don't be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. And so there's a continual repetition of encouragement here to Joshua. And it would seem odd to me that God would feel the need to tell him to be strong, to be brave, to not be afraid. If he wasn't feeling those things, if he wasn't fearful, why would God need to say this to him so many times? And this happens in the life of Abraham as well, that God has to come to him in a few times where he's run into friction with the people of the land. And God is saying to Abraham, don't be afraid, Abraham, I'm with you. And if Joshua wasn't feeling very insecure and fearful and uncertain here, why would God need to be continually reiterating to him, come on, Joshua, it's going to be okay. I sent you here. This is part of my purpose. I'm going to be with you like I was with Moses. And so I see Joshua chapter 2 in the story of Rahab as almost an answer to God to Joshua. And the fear he's needing, and for him having to look somewhere to find courage. So when a loving father sees that his son needs encouragement, that Joshua, who was to take his people into the promised land, needs encouragement, he encourages him through the voice of a prostitute in Jericho. And could Joshua have expected this? It's almost like when Gideon was told to get close to the, Amalekite army? And the one Amalekite was telling the other guy the dream that he had about the little bread bun that would come rolling down the hill and destroy their camp. And so it's true that there's the story of Rahab here and her faith. But I believe that there's also a loving father giving encouragement to Joshua, his son. So we read in chapter 1, God exhorting Joshua to be courageous. And the next time we hear those words, be strong and courageous, it's Joshua telling them to the people. So somewhere in this process, Joshua did get that courage. And when I see God, I believe, speaking to Joshua in this way, I think also of Jesus on the cross. And the reason for that is I heard someone in a talk or read it in a book a long time ago that they said that the incident with the thief on the cross, I think it was a brother who had studied that, and he said he could not find a hint anywhere in the Old Testament that would have suggested that such a thing would have happened. He did not think that there was any way that Jesus could have anticipated that in his final hours, as he was on the cross, one of the people crucified with him would have suddenly spoken up with a vehement faith and expressed his confidence that Jesus was going to come back and he was going to set up his kingdom. And so I see a parallel in these two incidents between Joshua and Jesus, both in critical moments in their lives, and God seeing that crisis that they were going through, and God reaching out to speak to them in really what would have been completely unexpected ways. And we think of Corinthians and how God says that he's not manifested through the rich and through the powerful of this world, but through the humble and through the weak. So in their battles, in Joshua's battle with his fear, in Jesus going through his final hours on the cross, I see a story of a loving father who, on the one hand, doesn't let anyone perish who could be saved. Rahab was savable, and God does not let her perish. The thief was savable, and God does not let him perish. But I also see a story of a loving father who uses a prostitute from Jericho or a thief to give encouragement to his children. I'd like to end in Psalms chapter 103. So I guess like all exhortations, we're learning about people like us that we can relate to or identify with. But most of all, we're learning about our Father. We're learning about our Father's love for us and the ways in which he cares for us. Psalm 103 says, "For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his steadfast love towards those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far does he remove our transgressions from us. And as a father shows compassion to his children, so the Lord shows compassion to those who fear him. For he knows our frame, and he remembers that we are dust."